said Ksenia Nikitishna. She probably thought, I don't care if I live or die, but I feel sorry for the poor kitten. But really, cried Kuzmin, and what about the milk? Did she bring that too, and the saucer as well? She brought it in a bottle and poured it into a saucer here, volunteered Ksenia Nikitishna. No matter, take the kitten and the saucer away, said Kuzmin, escorting Ksenia Nikitishna to the door. When he went back, the situation had changed. As he was hanging up his robe, the doctor heard laughter in the courtyard. He looked out and was naturally struck dumb. A woman, wearing only a chemise, was running across the yard to the building opposite. The doctor even knew who it was, Maria Alexandrovna. A boy was giggling. What's going on? Said Kuzmin contemptuously. Just then, on the other side of the wall, in his daughter's room, the foxtrot Hallelujah started playing on the phonograph. And at the same moment, a sparrow started chirping behind Kuzmin's back. He turned around and saw a huge sparrow hopping on top of his desk. Just keep calm, the doctor said to himself. It must have flown in when I had my back to the window. Everything's okay, the doctor told himself, feeling in his heart that everything was not okay, and mainly, of course, because of the sparrow. When he looked at it more closely, the doctor realized immediately that it was not exactly an ordinary sparrow. The filthy bird was lame in its left foot and was behaving in an obviously affected way, dragging the foot in syncopated rhythm. In a word, the sparrow was doing a foxtrot to the music playing on the phonograph, like a drunk at a bar. The bird acted as rudely as it knew how, staring insolently at the doctor. Kuzmin reached for the phone, thinking that he would call his old classmate and colleague, Burier, to ask him what it meant when you started seeing sparrows like that at age 60 and when your head was spinning to boot. Meanwhile, the sparrow landed on the inkstand, which had been given to the doctor as a gift, befouled it, I'm not kidding, flew up in the air, hovered briefly, and then, with a steely beak, pecked furiously at the glass on the graduation photo of the class of 1894, shattering it to bits. After that, it flew out the window. Instead of calling Boyer, the professor decided to call the Bureau of Leeches, saying that he, Dr. Kuzmin, wanted them to send him over some leeches right away. After putting down the receiver, the doctor turned back to his desk and immediately let out a wail. Sitting at his desk, wearing a nurse's kerchief, was a woman with a bag that said leeches. The doctor screamed when he saw her mouth. It was a man's mouth, crooked, open to the ears, with one fang sticking out. The nurse's eyes were dead. "I'll take the money," said the nurse in a man's bass voice. "No point in it lying around here." She raked up the champagne labels with a bird's claw and melted into thin air. 2 hours went by. Dr. Kuzmin was sitting in bed in his room, with leeches stuck to his temples, his neck, and behind his ears. On the silk quilt at his feet sat the gray-whiskered Dr. Burier, looking at him with sympathy and trying to reassure him that it was all nonsense. Outside the window, it was already night. We have no idea whether there were any other strange occurrences in Moscow that night, and we have no intention of trying to find out, since the time has come for us to proceed to part two of this true narrative. Follow me, reader. Part 2, Chapter 19. Margarita. Follow me, reader. Who ever told you there is no such thing in the world as real, true, everlasting love? May the liar have his despicable tongue cut out. Follow me, my reader, and only me, and I'll show you that kind of love. No, the master was mistaken that night in the hospital when, just after midnight, he told Ivan bitterly that she had forgotten him. That could never be. Of course she hadn't forgotten him. First, let me tell you the secret the master didn't want to tell Ivan. His beloved's name was Margarita Nikolaevna. Everything the master said about her to the poor poet was absolutely true. His description of his beloved was accurate. She was beautiful and intelligent. And one more thing. It can be said with assurance that many women would have given anything to trade places with Margarita Nikolaevna. The childless 30-year-old Margarita was married to an outstanding specialist who had made an extremely important discovery of national significance. Her husband was young, handsome, kind, honest, and adored his wife. Margarita Nikolaevna and her husband occupied the entire upper floor of a beautiful house in a garden on one of the small streets near the Arbat. An enchanting spot. Anyone who wishes to can take a look at the garden and see for himself. Let him ask me, and I'll give him the address and show him the way. The house is still standing to this very day. Margarita Nikolaevna had plenty of money. Margarita Nikolaevna could buy anything that took her fancy. Her husband's circle of friends included some interesting people. Margarita Nikolaevna never touched a Primus stove. Margarita Nikolaevna was ignorant of the horrors of life in a communal apartment. In a word, was she happy? Not for a minute. She hadn't been happy since marrying at age 19 and going to live in her husband's house. Gods, my gods, what did this woman want? What did this woman want whose eyes always burned with an incomprehensible fire? This witch, with a slight squint in one eye, who adorned herself with mimosa in springtime, what did she want? I do not know. I have no idea. Evidently, she spoke the truth when she said it was the master she needed, and not the Gothic-style house, the private garden, or the money. She loved him. She was telling the truth. Even I, a truthful narrator, but a detached observer nonetheless, feel my heart contract when I think of what Margarita went through the next day when she came to the master's house and found that he was no longer there. Fortunately, she had not as yet had a talk with her husband, who had not come home when he was supposed to. She did everything she could to find out what had happened to the master and, of course, had no success whatsoever. She then went back to her house and resumed her former life. But as soon as the dirty snow disappeared from the sidewalks and pavements, as soon as the damp, restless wind of spring tugged at the fortuchka, Margarita Nikolaevna began to feel even more miserable than she had during the winter. She often cried in secret, long and bitter tears. She didn't know whether the man she loved was alive or dead. And as the despairing days passed, the thought came to her more and more, especially at twilight, that she was tied to a dead man. She should either forget him or die herself. It was really impossible to go on with the life she was living. Impossible. Forget him, no matter what it cost. Forget him. But he could not be forgotten. That was the trouble. Yes, 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 I made the very same mistake, Margarita would say as she sat by the stove and stared at the fire, which had been lit in memory of the fire that burned when he was writing Pontius Pilate. Why did I leave him that night? Why? I must have been crazy. I came back the next day just as I said I would. But it was already too late. Yes, like poor Levi Matvei, I came back too late. All of this was absurd, of course. Since how would her staying with the master that night have made things any different? Could she really have saved him? Nonsense, we would have exclaimed. But not in front of a woman who has been driven to despair. Margarita Nikolaevna lived in this kind of torment throughout the winter and into the spring. On that same day, when there was all the commotion caused by the black magician's appearance in Moscow, on Friday, when Berlioz's uncle was sent packing back to Kiev, when the bookkeeper was arrested, and when many other grotesque and baffling things took place, Margarita woke up around noontime in her bedroom, which had a bay window looking out on the tower of the house. Upon awakening, Margarita did not burst into tears as she often did, because she woke up with a premonition that on that day something was finally going to happen. Once she sensed this premonition, She nurtured it, wanting it to take root in her soul and fearing that it would leave her. "I believe," Margarita whispered solemnly, "I believe something's going to happen. It can't help but happen, because why, in fact, have I been made to suffer for life? I admit that I've cheated and lied and lived a secret life hidden from everyone, but even that doesn't deserve such cruel punishment. Something is bound to happen, because nothing lasts forever. And besides, the dream I had was prophetic. I swear it was." This is what Margarita Nikolaevna whispered to herself as she gazed at the crimson shades suffused with sunlight, nervously got dressed, and combed her short, curly hair before the triple mirror of her vanity table. Margarita's dream that night had truly been unusual. The fact was that she had not dreamed about the master during that whole agonizing winter. At night he would leave her, and it was only during the daytime that she suffered. But now she had dreamed about him. Margarita had dreamed about an unfamiliar locale, a bleak and dismal place under an overcast early spring sky. Beneath a cover of patchy clouds, there was a flock of noiseless rooks. A rough bridge crossed a turbid, swollen stream. Dismal, scrubby, half-bare trees. A lone aspen, and beyond that, amidst trees and past a vegetable garden, was a log hut that could have been an outside kitchen, a bathhouse, or the devil knows what. The whole setting was so dead and dismal that it made you want to hang yourself on the aspen by the bridge. Not a breath of wind, not a cloud moving, not a living soul. A hellish place for a living being. And then, imagine, the door of the log hut opened and there he was, quite far away but clearly visible. He looked tattered, and you couldn't tell what he was wearing. His hair was disheveled, he was unshaven, his eyes looked pained and anxious. He was beckoning to her with his hand, calling to her. Choking in the dead air, Margarita started running to him over the furrowed ground, and then she woke up. "The dream can mean only one of two things," Margarita Nikolaevna reflected. "If he's dead and was beckoning to me, that means he's come for me and I shall die soon. That's very good, because my suffering will then end. Or if he's alive, then the dream can only mean that he's reminding me of his existence. He wants to tell me that we'll see each other again. Yes, we'll see each other very soon." Still excited, Margarita got dressed and tried to convince herself that in essence everything was turning out well, and that one had to know how to seize such opportunities and take advantage of them. Her husband had gone away on a business trip for 3 whole days. She had 3 whole days to herself, and nobody could stop her from thinking and daydreaming about whatever she pleased. She had the whole apartment to herself, 5 rooms on the upper floor of a private house that would be the envy of thousands of Muscovites. However, despite having the run of the house for 3 whole days, Margarita chose far from the best spot in that luxurious apartment. After drinking some tea, she went off to the dark, windowless room where the luggage was kept, and where there were 2 large bureaus filled with various old odds and ends. She squatted down in front of the first bureau and opened the bottom drawer. From beneath a pile of silk scraps, she took out the one possession she valued most in life. An old brown leather album which contained a photograph of the master, a savings book with 10,000 deposited in his name, dried rose petals pressed in tissue paper, and part of a typewritten manuscript that was singed at the bottom. Returning to her bedroom with these treasures, Margarita Nikolaevna set the picture against her triple mirror and sat in front of it for an hour or so, holding the fire-damaged manuscript on her knees as she leafed through and reread what, after the fire, had neither a beginning nor an end. The darkness that had come in from the Mediterranean covered the city so detested by the procurator. The hanging bridges which connected the temple with the fearsome Antonia Tower had disappeared, and an abyss descended from the sky, covering the winged gods above the hippodrome, the Hasmonean palace and its embrasures, the bazaars, the caravanseries, alleys and pools. Yerushalayim, the great city, vanished as if it had never existed. Margarita wanted to read more, but there was nothing more except the charred and tattered fringe. Wiping away her tears, Margarita Nikolaevna put down the manuscript and leaned her elbows on the vanity table. She sat there in front of the mirror for a long time, not taking her eyes off the master's picture. Then her tears dried. Margarita put all the things together neatly, and minutes later they were back in their hiding place beneath the silk rags, and the lock on the door to the dark room locked shut. Margarita Nikolaevna was putting her coat on in the front hall, getting ready to go out for a walk. The beautiful Natasha, her maid, asked her what she wanted for dinner. And when she said she didn't care, for amusement, Natasha began a casual conversation with her mistress and started relating God knows what, something about a magician at the theater yesterday who had performed astounding tricks, handing out free bottles of imported perfume and stockings, and then how, after the show, when everyone was out on the street, abracadabra, they were all naked. Margarita Nikolaevna collapsed on the chair beneath the hall mirror and burst out laughing. "Natasha, shame on you," said Margarita. "A girl like you who knows how to read. People in lines make up the devil knows what, and here you go repeating it." Natasha blushed a deep red and protested heatedly that nothing was made up and that she herself had been in a food store on the Arbat today and had seen a woman come in wearing shoes, but when she went to pay the cashier, her shoes disappeared off her feet and she was left standing in her stockings. Her eyes popped. There was a hole in her heel, and the shoes were the magic ones she had gotten at the show. "And she left just like that?" "Just like that," cried Natasha, blushing even deeper because she wasn't being believed. "And last night, Margarita Nikolaevna, the police picked up about 100 people. Women who had been at the show were running down Tverskaya in nothing but their drawers." "Well, naturally you got all this from Daria," said Margarita Nikolaevna. "I've known for a long time that she's a terrible liar." The amusing conversation ended in a pleasant surprise for Natasha. Margarita Nikolaevna went into her bedroom and came out with a pair of stockings and a bottle of cologne. Saying that she wanted to do a trick too, she gave them to Natasha and asked only one thing in return, that she not run down Tverskaya in just her stockings, and that she not listen to Daria. Mistress and maid then kissed and parted.
This ends Disc 8. The Master and Margarita, Disc 9.
Settling back against the soft, comfortable seat of the trolleybus, Margarita rode along the Arbat, thinking about her own affairs and eavesdropping on the hushed conversation of the two men sitting in front of her. They were whispering some sort of gibberish to each other, turning around now and then in fear of being overheard. The robust, beefy fellow with sharp, pig-like eyes sitting by the window was softly telling the little man next to him that they had had to cover the coffin with a black cloth. "Impossible," the little one whispered in astonishment. "That's preposterous. So what did Yeldyubin do?" Along with the steady drone of the bus came words from the window. "Criminal investigation, scandal, complete bafflement." Margarita Nikolaevna managed to make some sense out of these disconnected bits of conversation. They were whispering about how the head of some corpse, whose they didn't say, had been stolen out of its coffin that very morning. And that was why the man named Yeldyubin was in such a state. The two men whispering also seemed to have some connection with the vandalized corpse. "Will we have time to buy flowers?" worried the little one. "Didn't you say the cremation was at 2? In the end, Margarita Nikolaevna got fed up listening to the mysterious prattle about a stolen head, and she was glad when it was time for her to get off. Minutes later, Margarita Nikolaevna was sitting on one of the benches beneath the Kremlin wall, having positioned herself so that she had view of the manege. Margarita squinted in the bright sunlight, recalled her dream of the previous night, and recalled that exactly 1 year before, on the same day and at the same time, she had been sitting with him on this same bench. And her black bag was lying beside her on the bench just as it had then. Although he wasn't with her now, Margarita Nikolaevna was talking to him in her thoughts. "If you've been exiled, why haven't you let me know? People do manage to let others know. Have you fallen out of love with me?" "No, somehow I can't believe that. That means you were exiled and died. Then I beg you, release me, give me the freedom to live and breathe." Margarita Nikolaevna answered for him, "You are free. Am I stopping you?" Then she protested, "What kind of an answer is that? No, make me forget you, then I'll be free." People walked past Margarita Nikolaevna. A man gave the well-dressed woman a sidelong glance, attracted by her beauty and the fact that she was alone. He coughed and sat down at the end of the bench where Margarita Nikolaevna was sitting, and after gathering up his courage said, "Decidedly beautiful weather today." But Margarita gave him such a glowering look that he got up and left. "That's what I mean," said Margarita in her head to the man who possessed her. "Why, really, did I chase that man away? I'm bored, and there was nothing wrong with that Lovelace, except perhaps for his stupid decidedly. Why am I sitting here alone beneath the wall like an owl? Why am I cut off from life?" She became totally sad and depressed. But suddenly, that morning's wave of expectation and excitement hit her in the chest. Yes, something is going to happen. The wave hit her again, and then she realized it was a wave of sound. The beating of drums and the blaring of trumpets, slightly off-key, could be heard with ever-increasing clarity through the din of the city. Leading the procession that was passing the park railing was a mounted policeman, followed by 3 men on foot. Next came the musicians on a slow-moving truck. After that, a brand-new open hearse carrying a wreath-covered coffin and 4 people, 3 men and a woman, each of whom were standing on a corner of the platform. Even from a distance, Margarita could tell that the faces of those standing in the hearse accompanying the deceased on his last journey looked strangely perplexed. This was especially true of the woman standing in the left rear corner of the vehicle. Her plump cheeks seemed to be bursting with some kind of juicy secret, and there was an ambiguous sparkle in her puffy little eyes. It seemed as if she couldn't contain herself, and was about to wink at the deceased and say, "Have you ever seen anything like it? A real mystery." Similarly perplexed faces could be seen on the 300 or so mourners walking slowly behind the hearse. Margarita watched the procession as it passed, listening to the fading sounds of the mournful bass drum beating out its ever-constant boom, boom, boom. "What an odd funeral," she thought, "and how depressing that boom is. Ah, really, I'd sell my soul to the devil if I could only find out if he's still alive or not. Who, I wonder, are those amazed-looking people burying?"
"Mikhail Alexandrovich Berlioz," said a somewhat nasal, masculine voice beside her, "the chairman of Masolit."
Surprised, Margarita Nikolaevna turned and saw a man at the other end of the bench, who must have sat down noiselessly when she was preoccupied with the procession and presumably had asked her last question out loud, without knowing it. Meanwhile, the procession had come to a halt, probably because of the traffic lights up ahead.
"Yes," the stranger continued, "their mood is amazing. They're taking someone to be buried, and all they can think about is what happened to his head."
"What head?" asked Margarita, peering at her unexpected neighbor, who turned out to be a short man with fiery red hair and a fang, who was wearing a starched shirt, a fine striped suit, patent leather shoes, and a bowler hat. His tie was flashy, but the most astonishing thing of all was that sticking out of his breast pocket, where most men carry a handkerchief or a pen, there was a well-gnawed chicken bone.
"Well, you see," the redhead explained, "this morning at Griboyedov, the dead man's head was removed from his coffin."
"But how can that be?" Margarita asked involuntarily, recalling the whispers she had overheard on the bus.
"The devil knows how," the redhead replied casually. "But if you ask me, it might be worth asking Behemoth about that. A terribly clever theft it was, too, caused an unbelievable scandal. And what's more, no one knows who would need the head or why."
However preoccupied Margarita Nikolaevna was with her own concerns, she was nonetheless struck by the stranger's bizarre chatter. "But wait a minute," she blurted out. "Which Berlioz? Was it the one in today's paper who..."
"Precisely so. Precisely so."
"So does that mean that the mourners are writers?" asked Margarita, suddenly baring her teeth.
"Yes, naturally."
"And do you know who they are by sight?"
"Every last one," replied the redhead.
"Tell me," said Margarita, her voice becoming hollow, "is the critic Latunsky among them by any chance?"
"How could he not be?" answered the redhead. "There he is, over there, fourth row from the end."
"The blonde one?" asked Margarita, squinting.
"Ash blonde. See? He's got his eyes raised up to heaven."
"The one who looks like a Catholic priest?"
"That's him."
Studying Latunsky, Margarita asked no more questions.
"And you, I can see," said the redhead, smiling, "hate this Latunsky."
"I also hate a few others," answered Margarita through her teeth. "But it's not worth talking about." By now, the procession had moved on. A line of mostly empty cars stretched out behind the marchers.
"If you say so, Margarita Nikolaevna."
Margarita was astounded. "Do you know me?" In place of an answer, the redhead swept the bowler off his head and held it in his outstretched hand. "Looks like a real thug," thought Margarita, examining her sidewalk interlocutor. "But I don't know you," said Margarita dryly.
"How could you know me? But I've been sent to see you regarding a certain small matter."
Margarita turned pale and recoiled. "You should have said that right away," she began, "instead of spouting the devil knows what about a severed head. Have you come to arrest me?"
"Not at all," exclaimed the redhead. "What is this? As soon as you start talking, they think you're going to arrest them. I simply have some business to discuss with you."
"I don't understand at all. What business?" The redhead looked around and said mysteriously,
"I've been sent to give you an invitation for this evening."
"Are you raving? An invitation from whom?"
"A certain distinguished foreigner," said the redhead, narrowing his eyes meaningfully.
Margarita got furious. "A new breed has appeared, street pimps," she said, getting up to leave.
"That's the thanks I get for taking on assignments like this," exclaimed the redhead, taking offense.
And as Margarita turned to leave, he growled after her,
"Fool!"
"Scoundrel!" she retorted, and as she turned, she heard the redhead's voice behind her.
"The darkness that had come in from the Mediterranean covered this city so detested by the procurator. The hanging bridges which connected the temple with the fearsome Antonia Tower had disappeared. Jerusalem, the great city, vanished as if it had never existed. And you can vanish, too, along with your charred manuscript and your dried rose. Sit here on the bench alone and beg him to set you free so you can breathe and be allowed to forget him."
Margarita's face blanched, and she turned back to the bench. The redhead looked at her with tightly narrowed eyes. I don't understand any of this, said Margarita Nikolaevna softly. You could have found out about the burnt pages, broken into my house and spied on me. Did you pay off Natasha, is that it? But how could you know my thoughts? She wrinkled her brow, looking agonized, and added, Tell me, who are you? What department are you from?
What a bore this is, grumbled the redhead and said in a louder voice, Excuse me, but I already told you I'm not from any department. Please sit down.
Margarita obeyed without a fuss. But as she sat down, she asked again, Who are you?
Well, if you must know, my name is Azazello. But that won't mean anything to you anyway.
But won't you tell me how you knew about those pages and about my thoughts?
No, I won't,
was Azazello's dry reply. But do you know anything about him? Whispered Margarita imploringly.
Well, let's say I do.
I beg you, just tell me one thing. Is he alive? Don't torment me.
Yes, he's alive. He's alive,
Azazello replied unwillingly. My God!
Please, no fits and no screams, said Azazello with a frown.
I'm sorry, forgive me, mumbled the now compliant Margarita. It's true, I got angry at you. You will admit, though, that when someone on the street invites a woman to go somewhere... I'm not prejudiced, I assure you, Margarita let out a mirthless laugh. But I never see any foreigners. I have no desire to socialize with them. And besides, my husband... My tragedy is that I live with someone I don't love, but it would be ignoble of me to ruin his life. He's never shown me anything but kindness. Azazello listened to her disconnected speech with obvious boredom and said sternly,
Please, be quiet for a minute.
Margarita fell into submissive silence.
My invitation is from a foreigner who is perfectly safe, and not a soul will know about your visit, I can promise you that.
But what does he need me for? Margarita asked insinuatingly.
You'll find that out later.
I see. I'm supposed to sleep with him, said Margarita reflectively. Azazello gave a haughty smirk and replied,
That would, I can assure you, be the answer to any woman's dream.
A chuckle distorted Azazello's face.
But I must disappoint you. That won't happen.
But who is this foreigner? Margarita cried out loudly in exasperation, causing passers-by to turn their heads. And why should I have any interest in seeing him? Azazello leaned over to her and whispered in a gravely significant way,
A great interest indeed. You'll have the opportunity to...
To do what? Exclaimed Margarita, her eyes widening. Am I right? Are you suggesting that I can get news of him there? Azazello nodded silently. Then I'll go, Margarita exclaimed with vigor, seizing Azazello by the arm. I'll go anywhere you want. Heaving a sigh of relief, Azazello leaned back against the bench, which had the name Nura carved in large letters on it, and observed ironically,
A troublesome race, these women.
He buried his hands in his pockets and stretched his legs out in front of him.
Why did they send me on this job? Behemoth should have gone. He's the one with the charm.
With a bitterly sad smile, Margarita said, Stop trying to mystify and torment me with your riddles. I'm an unhappy person, and you're taking advantage of that. I may be getting involved in something strange, but if I am, I swear it's only because you lured me with your talk of him. My head is spinning from all these things I don't understand.
No scenes, no scenes, retorted Azazello with a grimace. You should put yourself in my position, smacking some bureaucrat in the puss, booting out some old geezer, shooting someone, or anything along those lines. That's my real specialty. But talking with a woman in love? No thanks. I've been trying to talk you into this for half an hour now, so will you go?
I'll go, was Margarita Nikolaevna's simple reply.
Then be so kind as to take this, said Azazello, who pulled a round gold jar out of his pocket and handed it to Margarita, saying, Hide it, or people will see. It'll do you good, Margarita Nikolaevna. Your grief has really aged you in the past 6 months.
Margarita flared up, but said nothing. And Azazello continued,
"Tonight, at exactly 9:30, be so kind as to take off your clothes and spread this ointment over your face and your whole body. Then you can do as you like, but don't leave the phone. I'll call you at 10 and tell you everything you need to know. You don't have to worry about anything. You'll be taken where you have to go, and you won't be caused any upset. Understood?"
After a short silence, Margarita replied, "Understood. This thing is pure gold, I can tell by the weight. Well, what of it? I know perfectly well that I'm being bribed and lured into some shady business for which I'll have to pay a high price."
"What is this?" said Azazello, practically hissing. "Are you starting in again?
No, wait.
Give me back the cream."
Margarita clutched the jar tighter and continued, "No, wait. I know what I'm getting myself in for. But I'll do anything for his sake, because there's no hope left for me in this world. But if you destroy me, you'll be sorry. Yes, you will, because I'll be dying for love." And pounding her chest, Margarita gazed at the sun.
"Give it back!" Azazello yelled angrily. "Give it back, and to hell with everything! Let them send Behemoth!"
"Oh, no!" exclaimed Margarita, to the astonishment of passers-by. "I agree to everything. I agree to play out this whole comedy with the cream. I agree to go to the devil and back. I won't give it back."
"Bah!"
Azazello howled suddenly. His eyes bulging, he began pointing at something over toward the park railing. Margarita turned to where Azazello was pointing, but didn't notice anything in particular. Then she turned back to him, expecting an explanation for that absurd bah, but there was no one there to provide it. Margarita Nikolaevna's mysterious interlocutor had vanished. Margarita quickly thrust her hand into her bag, where, prior to Azazello's howl, she had hidden the jar, and assured herself that it was still there. Then, without further reflection, she ran hurriedly out of Alexandrovsky Park. Chapter 20. Azazello's Cream. The full moon hung in the clear evening sky, visible through the branches of the maple tree. The lindens and acacias traced an intricate pattern of spots on the garden floor. The triple casement bay window, wide open but with blinds drawn, shone with a harsh electric light. The lights in Margarita Nikolaevna's bedroom were all turned on, revealing a state of total chaos. Chemises, stockings, and underwear were lying on the blanket on top of the bed, and other undergarments were strewn on the floor, along with a pack of cigarettes that had gotten crushed in the excitement. There were slippers on the night table next to an unfinished cup of coffee, and an ashtray that held a smoking cigarette butt. A black evening gown hung on the back of a chair. The room smelled of perfume. And from somewhere came the smell of a red-hot iron. Margarita Nikolaevna was sitting before her mirror in a bathrobe, which had been thrown over her naked body, and black suede shoes. In front of her lay a gold watch, and next to it the small jar she had received from Azazello. Margarita's eyes were glued to the watch. At times it seemed to her as if the watch were broken and the hands weren't moving. But they were moving, albeit very slowly, as if they kept getting stuck, and finally the big hand hit 9:29. Margarita's heart gave such a terrible thump that at first she couldn't even pick up the jar. When she pulled herself together and opened the jar, she saw that it contained a greasy, yellowish cream which seemed to smell of swamp mud. With the tip of her finger, Margarita scooped up a small glob of the cream and put it in her palm, which made the swampy, woodland smell more noticeable. She then began rubbing the cream into her cheeks and forehead. The cream spread easily and seemed to be absorbed immediately. After several applications of the cream, Margarita looked in the mirror and dropped the jar on the face of her watch, cracking the crystal. She closed her eyes, took another look, and burst into wild laughter. Her eyebrows, which had been plucked thread-thin at the ends, had thickened. and now arched evenly over her eyes, which had become green. There was no longer any trace of the tiny vertical line on the bridge of her nose, which had first appeared back in October when the master disappeared. Gone, too, were the yellowish shadows around her temples and the barely noticeable crow's feet at the outer corners of her eyes. Her cheeks were suffused with a rosy blush. Her forehead had become clear and white, and her hair salon permanent wave had loosened. There in the mirror, staring back at 30-year-old Margarita, was a 20-year-old woman with naturally curly black hair, showing her teeth and laughing unrestrainedly. Having laughed her fill, Margarita swept off her robe, scooped up a generous glob of the light, greasy cream, and began rubbing it vigorously all over her body, which immediately became rosy and began to glow. Then, the throbbing in her temple, which had been bothering her all evening, ever since her meeting with Azazello in Alexandrovsky Park, disappeared in a flash, as if a needle had been removed from her brain. The muscles in her arms and legs got stronger, and then Margarita's body became weightless. She gave a little jump and stayed suspended in the air just above the carpet. Then she felt a slow downward pull and was back on the ground. "Oh, what a cream! What a cream!" cried Margarita, throwing herself into an armchair. The cream had transformed more than her appearance. Now her whole body, every part of it, surged with joy, and she felt as if tiny bubbles were prickling her all over. Margarita felt free, free of everything. In addition, she realized with utter clarity that her premonition of the morning had come true, and she was leaving her house and her former life forever. But one thought from that former life still persisted, namely, that there was one last thing she had to do before embarking on the new and extraordinary something that was pulling her upwards into the air. So, naked as she was, flying intermittently, she ran out of the bedroom into her husband's study, turned on the lights, and rushed to the desk. On a sheet of paper torn off a pad, she wrote in pencil, quickly and boldly and without any corrections, the following note. "Forgive me and forget me as quickly as you can. I'm leaving you forever. Don't try to find me. It's useless. I've become a witch because of the grief and the misfortunes that have befallen me. It is time for me to go. Farewell. Margarita." Her soul relieved of every care, Margarita flew back into her bedroom, and Natasha ran in after her, loaded down with all sorts of things. And suddenly, everything, a dress on a wooden hanger, lace shawls, dark blue silk shoes on shoe trees, and a belt, fell to the floor, and Natasha clasped her now free hands. "Well, do I look good?" cried Margarita loudly in a husky voice. "How did it happen?" whispered Natasha, reeling backwards. "How did you do it, Margarita Nikolaevna?" "It's the cream, the cream, the cream," replied Margarita, pointing to the gleaming gold jar and doing a turn in front of the mirror. Forgetting about the crumpled dress on the floor, Natasha ran over to the mirror and stared with voracious, burning eyes at what was left of the cream. Her lips whispered something. She turned again to Margarita and said, with a kind of reverence, "What skin! What skin! Why, Margarita Nikolaevna, your skin is glowing!" But then she remembered herself, ran over and picked up the dress and began smoothing it out. "Put it down! Put it down!" Margarita shouted at her. "The devil with it! Throw everything out! Or rather, keep it as a memento, to remember me by. You can take everything in the room." Natasha stood for a while as if in a daze, staring at Margarita. Then she fell on her neck, kissing her and shouting, "Like satin, it glows, like satin, and your eyebrows, what eyebrows!" "Take all this stuff and the perfume, too, and put it in your trunk and hide it," shouted Margarita. "But don't take the jewelry, or they'll accuse you of stealing." Natasha put whatever came to hand into a bundle, dresses, shoes, stockings, and underwear, and ran out of the bedroom. Just then, the sounds of a virtuoso waltz came blaring through an open window across the street, and a car was heard spluttering as it pulled up to the gates. "Azazello will call any minute," exclaimed Margarita, listening to the waltz streaming in from outside. Yes, he will, and the foreigner is harmless. Yes, I can see that now. He's harmless. The car roared and pulled away from the gates. The gate banged, and steps were heard coming down the path. That's Nikolai Ivanovich, I can tell by his footsteps, thought Margarita. I'll have to do something interesting and amusing as a way of saying goodbye. Margarita pulled the shade aside and sat sideways on the windowsill, her hands clasped on her knee. The moonlight caressed her right side. Margarita raised her head toward the moon and assumed a pensive and poetic expression. Footsteps were heard once or twice again, and then they suddenly stopped. After admiring the moon a little longer, Margarita sighed for the sake of appearances and turned to look down at the garden where she did in fact see Nikolai Ivanovich, who lived on the floor below her. Bathed in bright moonlight, he was sitting on a bench, and it was obvious that he had sat down suddenly. His pince-nez was askew, and he was clutching his briefcase to his chest.
"Well, hello, Nikolai Ivanovich," said Margarita in a sad voice. "Good evening. Have you come from a meeting?"
Nikolai Ivanovich made no reply.
"I, as you can see," Margarita continued, leaning further out into the garden, "have been sitting here all alone, bored, looking at the moon and listening to the waltz."
Margarita passed her left hand across her forehead, adjusting a stray curl, then said angrily, "That's not polite, Nikolai Ivanovich. I am a lady, after all. It's rude not to answer when someone is talking to you." Nikolai Ivanovich, visible in the moonlight down to the last button on his gray waistcoat, the last hair on his blonde goatee, suddenly grinned a wild grin, got up from the bench, and obviously, beside himself with embarrassment, did not remove his hat, as one would have expected, but rather waved his briefcase to the side and got into a crouching position, as if he were about to do a Russian dance.
"Oh, what a bore you are, Nikolai Ivanovich," continued Margarita. "I can't tell you how sick and tired I am of all of you, and how happy I am to be leaving you. To the devil's mother with all of you."
Just then, Margarita heard the phone ring in the bedroom behind her. She jumped off the windowsill and, forgetting about Nikolai Ivanovich, grabbed the receiver.
"It's Azazello," said the voice in her ear.
"Dear, dear Azazello," exclaimed Margarita.
"It's time to fly away," said Azazello,
and it was clear from his tone that he was pleased with Margarita's genuine display of joy.
"When you fly over the gates, shout, 'I'm invisible!' Then fly around over the city for a while to get used to it, and after that head south, away from the city, and go straight to the river. They're expecting you."
Margarita hung up the phone, at which point something wooden-sounding started bumping around in the next room and began knocking at the door. Margarita opened the door, and in flew a dancing broom, brush end up. It tapped a few beats on the floor with its handle, gave a kick, and strained toward the window. Margarita squealed with delight and jumped astride the broomstick. Only then did she remember that in all the confusion, she had forgotten to get dressed. She galloped over to the bed and grabbed the first thing she saw, a light blue chemise. Waving it like a banner, she flew out the window, and the sound of the waltz over the garden intensified. Margarita slipped down from the window and saw Nikolai Ivanovich on the bench. He seemed to be frozen to it and was listening in a stupefied state to the banging and shouting coming from the lighted bedroom of his upstairs neighbors.
"Farewell, Nikolai Ivanovich," cried Margarita, dancing about in front of him.
He groaned and began edging down the bench, feeling his way with his hands and knocking his briefcase to the ground.
"Goodbye forever! I'm flying away," shouted Margarita, drowning out the waltz.
She then decided that she had no need of the chemise, and with an ominous chuckle, she threw it over Nikolai Ivanovich's head. Blinded, he tumbled off the bench onto the bricks of the path. Margarita turned to take one last look at the house where she had suffered so long, and in the lighted window she saw Natasha
gaping with astonishment. "Farewell, Natasha!" Margarita shouted and urged her broom upward. "Invisible! I'm invisible!" she shouted even more loudly, and with the branches of the maple tree brushing against her face, she flew out over the gates and into the street. And the totally crazed waltz followed her aloft. Chapter 21. Flight. Invisible and free. Invisible and free. After flying down her own street, Margarita came to another one which crossed it at a right angle. In an instant, she cut across this long and crooked, patched and mended side street with its oil shop, with the rickety door which sold kerosene by the jugful and pesticide in bottles, and it was here that she learned that however enjoyable her freedom and invisibility were, she still had to be somewhat careful. It was only by some miracle that she avoided a fatal collision with the rickety old lamppost down at the corner. After dodging it successfully, Margarita took a firmer hold of her broomstick and checked her speed, keeping a watchful eye out for electric wires and signs hanging over the sidewalk. The third street on her route led directly to the Arbat. It was here that Margarita gained full mastery of her broom and realized how sensitive it was to the slightest touch of her hands or feet, and that she would have to be very careful flying over the city and not be too reckless. In addition, it was obvious to her, even before she got to the Arbat, that people on the street could not see her flying. Nobody craned his head or shouted, "Look, look," or jumped out of the way, or screamed, or fainted, or broke out in wild laughter. Margarita flew along noiselessly, at very slow speed and not too high up, at about second-story level. But even at slow speed, just as she was about to come out onto the blindingly lit Arbat, she made a slight miscalculation and hit her shoulder against an illuminated circular sign with an arrow painted on it. This made her angry. She reined in her obedient broom, flew over to the side, and then made a sudden charge at the sign, smashing it to smithereens with the end of her broom handle. Splinters crashed, pedestrians jumped out of the way, a whistle blew, and Margarita, the perpetrator of this gratuitous prank, burst out into gales of laughter. "I should be more careful on the Arbat," she thought. "Everything is so mixed up here that you get confused." She began diving between the various wires. The tops of cars, trolley buses, and buses floated by beneath her, and rivers of hats flowed along the sidewalks, or so it seemed, from up high. Streams branched off these rivers and flowed into the fiery maws of the stores open at night. "What a mess this is," thought Margarita in exasperation. "It's impossible to make a turn." She crossed the Arbat, flew higher, up to fourth-story level, floated past the blinding lights of the theater marquee on the corner, and into a narrow street with tall buildings. All their windows were wide open, and everywhere music could be heard playing on the radios. Out of curiosity, Margarita peered into one of the windows. She saw a kitchen. Two Primus stoves were roaring on top of the counter, and two women were standing next to it with spoons in their hands, squabbling. "I told you to turn off the light when you come out of the toilet, Pelageya Petrovna," said the woman standing in front of a saucepan steaming with food, "or we'll have you evicted." "You're a fine one to talk," the other replied. "You're two of a kind," said Margarita loudly and clearly as she rolled over the windowsill into the kitchen. The two squabblers turned toward the voice and froze, dirty spoons in hand. Reaching carefully between them, Margarita twisted the knobs on both stoves and turned them off. The women groaned and gasped, but Margarita had already become bored in the kitchen and had flown out into the street. At the end of the street, her attention was drawn to the lavish hulk of a newly constructed eight-story building. Margarita flew down and landed, and she saw that it had a black marble facade, wide doors, through whose glass one could see a doorman's gold-braided cap and the buttons on his uniform, and a sign in gold lettering over the entrance which said, "Dramlit House." Margarita squinted her eyes at the sign, trying to figure out what Dramlit might mean. Tucking her broom under her arm, She walked into the entrance and opened the door, knocking against the astonished doorman in the process. On the wall next to the elevator, she saw a huge black board that listed the names and apartment numbers of all the residents written on it in white letters. When she took one look at what was written at the top of the list, Writers and Dramatists House, she let out a stifled, predatory howl. Raising herself higher in the air, she began reading the names voraciously.
Khustov, Dubratsky, Kvant, Beskudnikov, Latunsky.
Latunsky! Screeched Margarita. Latunsky! Why, that's him! He's the one who ruined the master!
The doorman jumped in amazement, and his eyes bulged as he stared at the blackboard and tried to comprehend the miracle of the directory of residents suddenly letting out a scream. Margarita had, in the meantime, made a beeline upstairs and was repeating over and over in a kind of rapture,
Latunsky 84, Latunsky 84. Here's 82 on the left, 83 on the right, higher up on the left, 84, here. And here's the name card. Oh, Latunsky.
Margarita jumped off her broom, and the stone landing felt pleasantly cool against the soles of her inflamed feet. She rang the bell once, twice, but no one came to the door. As Margarita pressed the bell even harder, she could hear it ringing inside Latunsky's apartment. Yes, the resident of apartment number 84 on the 8th floor should be grateful to the deceased Berlioz for the rest of his days, grateful that the chairman of Masolit had fallen under a streetcar, and grateful that a memorial meeting had been set up for that very evening. The critic Latunsky was born under a lucky star. It saved him from an encounter with Margarita, who had become a witch on that Friday. No one answered the door. Then Margarita flew downwards at full speed, counting off the floors as she went, reached the bottom, tore out onto the street, and, looking up, counted off the floors on the outside of the building, trying to figure out which were the windows of Latunsky's apartment. They had to be the 5 dark ones at the corner of the building on the 8th floor. Sure that that was the case, Margarita rose up in the air, and a few seconds later, she was entering an open window into a room that was dark except for a narrow, silver strip of moonlight. Margarita followed it and fumbled for the light switch. A minute later, the lights were on in the whole apartment. Her broom was standing in a corner. Making sure that no one was home, Margarita opened the front door and checked the nameplate. It was the right one. Margarita had arrived at her destination. Yes, they say to this very day, the critic Latunsky turns pale when he recalls that terrible evening, and that he still pronounces Berlioz's name with reverence. No one knows what dark and foul crime might have marked that evening. When Margarita returned from the kitchen, she had a heavy hammer in her hands. The naked and invisible aeronaut tried to restrain and control herself, but her hands shook with impatience. Taking careful aim, Margarita struck the piano keys, and a first plaintive wail echoed throughout the apartment. The totally innocent Becker Baby Grand cried out in a frenzy. Its keys were smashed, and the ivory inlays flew in all directions. The instrument droned, howled, wheezed, and clinked. The polished upper sounding board cracked like a pistol shot and broke under the hammer. Breathing hard, Margarita tore at the strings and pounded them with her hammer. Finally exhausted, she backed off and plopped into an armchair to catch her breath. A sound of rushing water came from the bathroom and also from the kitchen. I guess it's already overflowed onto the floor, thought Margarita, and then added aloud, but there's no point in sitting around here. A stream of water was already pouring out of the kitchen into the hall. Tramping through the water in her bare feet, Margarita carried buckets of water from the kitchen to Latunsky's study and emptied them into the drawers of his desk. Then, after shattering the doors of the bookcase in the study with her hammer, Margarita descended upon the bedroom. After smashing the mirror on the wardrobe door, she pulled out one of the critic's suits and submerged it in the bathtub. She poured an inkwell full of ink, taken from the study, onto the luxuriously fluffed-up double bed in Latunsky's bedroom. The destruction she was causing gave Margarita intense pleasure. But the whole time it seemed to her that the damage she was causing was too slight. Therefore, she began striking out at random. She broke the pots of ficus plants in the room where the piano was. Before finishing that, she went back to the bedroom, slashed the sheets with a kitchen knife, and broke the glass-covered photographs. She did